Sup, you beautiful bastards. You're watching the Philip DeFranco Show. It's Monday. There's a lot of news to talk about today. And obviously, today is a road show. But there's a lot to talk about today. So buckle up. Just hit that like button to let YouTube know you like these big daily dives into the news. And let's jump into it.
This is a news show.
Oh, hi. You're in bed with me now. I'm sorry or you're welcome. One of the two. It's got crazy windy outside, so I had to come in. But the first thing that we have to talk about today are the big updates in the news around Kate Middleton.
In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London. And at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment.
So yeah, Kate Middleton has cancer. And if you're wondering what preventative chemotherapy is, it's basically a treatment meant to mop up any remaining cancer cells after the primary treatment or surgery. Or that meant to reduce the risk of the cancer coming back and spreading. And depending on the type and stage of Kate's cancer, which we don't currently know, this typically takes about 3 to 6 months. But, you know, this announcement comes as a shock for several reasons. One, because of course, it's just terrible for her personally, as well as the royal family, with King Charles disclosing his own cancer diagnosis last month. And two, because for weeks, the internet had collectively pulled its hair out trying to figure out what the hell was going on with Kate Middleton. Or she had kept out of the public eye ever since her surgery, and they were only releasing vague statements to the press. And when she did show her face, it only added more fuel to the fire. Like when she had to apologize for editing the family photo for Mother's Day. And so like we talked about, people on social media just churned out every conspiracy theory under the sun. Everything from she's dead, to she's in an induced coma, to she's recovering from a secret Brazilian butt lift, to she's pulled a Gone Girl and fled the palace. But on Saturday, she explained that it's taken time for her to recover from a major surgery so she can begin treatment. As well as for her and Prince William to privately process this and explain it to their kids in a way that's appropriate while reassuring them.
We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space, and privacy while I complete my treatment.
And while since this, the conspiracy theories may have quieted down, they haven't fully stopped. With some people claiming things like the video is deepfaked because supposedly her ring goes missing from her hand in some frames. Though as others have noted, that's just due to motion blur, and if you slow down the video, the ring is clearly visible. But as for the people who aren't staying in conspiracy land, there's been two main reactions to this news. First, you had many people blasting internet speculators for hounding a woman who was clearly going through something personal. And this actually including speculators or people who are memeing themselves. With this including the likes of Blake Lively, who previously responded to Kate's edited photo with one of her own trying to parody it, showing herself with an enlarged thumb, a lemon floating over her head, and her chair's seat separated from its back. But they're now saying on Instagram, I made a silly post around the Photoshop fails frenzy, and oh man, that post has me mortified today. I'm sorry, sending love and well wishes to all, always. But then also, we saw the second type of reaction, which points the blame not at social media, but at the royal family, arguing that they allowed conspiracy theories to flourish and even egg them on by completely bungling this whole thing for 2 months, including seemingly putting even more pressure on Kate by blaming her for creating that Photoshopped image. And among those, you had culture writer Sophie Ross telling the Washington Post, if we have a potentially missing princess, can you blame the public for speculating? I don't think anyone should feel bad except the public relations department of the royal family. But also, there's a third argument that these reactions aren't mutually exclusive, that both can be true, that the royal family fucked this up and that a lot of people got way out of control with conspiracies. With all this, I do want to pass a question off to you. What have your thoughts and feelings been since seeing this update and this news and also the reactions to it?
And then,
can we just stop body shaming Selena Gomez? Like, that's what a lot of the internet's saying right now. With many fans also getting pretty tired of saying it because this is not in any way the first time we've had this conversation. Though this latest, starting with Selena posting selfies on Instagram over the weekend, showing her in a bra and then quickly deleting them. With reports saying the photos were only up for a few minutes, it being unclear why she took them down. They did have some outlets noting she appeared to have a slight wardrobe malfunction, her top slipping, making the pictures potentially too revealing. But then of course with that, many people re-uploaded them to Twitter. And immediately, people were quick to body shame her and straight up call her ugly. Some even going into the archives and showing this clip from a 2016 AMA speech where she said,
I don't want to see your bodies on Instagram. I want to see what's in here.
With many posting that clip alongside those photos and calling her a hypocrite. We've also seen a response to that backlash, right? People noting that the clip is 8 years old, her stance on Instagram is allowed to change. Then others focusing on the shaming itself, noting that Selena has lupus and she's been very open about her struggles with that illness. And also having explained in the past that her medication for it causes her weight to fluctuate. And so with this, you saw people saying, you know, we should have learned from Chadwick Boseman not to comment on people's bodies. Especially in these situations where you know someone's dealing with medical issues. And others saying things like, lupus doesn't define me, but it's a part of my reality. reality. So when I see anyone, including Selena Gomez, being body shamed for their appearance, it hits close to home. We never truly know the battles others are fighting, just as they don't know ours. And everyone mocking Selena Gomez needs to touch grass. She has lupus, has had a kidney transplant, had chemotherapy, all while having a few different careers. She's dealt with it all in the public while internet weirdos snark about her appearance. And some people just going, how many times do we have to go over this? Saying it happens to Selena Gomez every year. Saying gets body shamed and made fun of, is accused of surgery, but adding gets off her meds, loses all the weight, then is accused of being on drugs. How can a simple selfie bring this much hate for her? And then on top of that, others saying lupus or not, body shaming's wrong even if someone isn't sick. Though that's also, you know, it's not gonna do anything to change the minds or the motives or the actions of people that have accounts out there that seem to be dedicated to talking about women over 30 have hit a wall. So unfortunately, this is kind of just another day of the internet with people yelling and probably no growth to be seen for most.
And then
Marjorie Taylor Greene wants Mike Johnson out, with MTG filing a motion to get Speaker Johnson removed from office, claiming that he betrayed Republicans by helping push through a $1.2 trillion spending package to narrowly avoid a government shutdown.
This is a betrayal of the American people. This is a betrayal of Republican voters.
And so you have Greene saying that her main issue with the bill is it does not do enough to address the situation at the southern border, a point that she's reiterated in tweet after tweet since the bill was passed. But this notably as there are quite a few wins for Republicans in the bill, and that's including on immigration with money for 2,000 new border patrol agents and additional ICE detention beds, as well as a 25% increase in funding for technology at the southern border. The bill also cuts funding for the State Department and foreign aid programs by roughly 6%, including a provision prohibiting taxpayer dollars from going to UNRWA. And on top of all that, Republicans even snuck in a provision banning the flying of LGBTQ pride flags over U.S. embassies, which obviously has nothing to do with the budget, and which the White House has vowed to try and repeal. But this also, as Greene isn't the only Republican to criticize the bill, with the likes of Andy Biggs of Arizona, for example, saying the bill was, quote, chock full of crap. And all of this is Greene's call for the removal of Speaker Johnson's a bit more problematic for some Republicans right now, right? Because as we've talked about, resignations by lawmakers like Ken Buck and Mike Gallagher have made the Republican majority in the House razor thin. And so we actually had Matt Gaetz, of course, the guy who introduced the motion to get rid of the previous speaker, saying, when I vacated the last one, I made a promise to the country that we would not end up with a Democrat speaker. I couldn't make that promise today. And so as of now, a vote on whether or not to remove Johnson won't take place for at least another 2 weeks, right after the House returns from recess. But already we're seeing several Democrats saying they hope to take advantage of the Republican infighting, possibly even agreeing to support Johnson if he helps pass his Ukraine aid. And you even had AOC saying to CNN that she wouldn't help Johnson for free or, quote, out of sympathy for Republicans. And this is she said that she's not inclined to vote for a speaker who doesn't believe in women's rights, doesn't believe in bodily autonomy, and who has supported overturning a presidential election. Otherwise, AOC and other Democrats would likely throw their support behind Hakeem Jeffries. But as far as what actually happens from here, we're gonna have to wait to see. Right? Is this just whining and posturing from MTG? And or is it about to be former Speaker Johnson? Or one day soon, we might be talking about Johnson's run in Scaramucci's. And then, though the dominoes are still falling with Boeing, with now just today the company announcing multiple massive leadership changes, including most significantly CEO David Calhoun will be stepping down from his role at the end of the year. And in a message to employees, Calhoun specifically noted the Alaska Airlines door plug debacle, saying that it represented a watershed moment for Boeing and adding, we must continue to respond to this accident with humility and complete transparency. We must inculcate a total commitment to safety and quality at every level of our company. And very notably here, Calhoun specifically told CNBC in an interview that all of the leadership changes announced today, including his own, were very deliberate. But this also, as the announcements have been described, as abrupt. Right? And Calhoun's departure is very, very significant, because he was actually brought on in 2020 specifically to lead Boeing after the company ousted its previous CEO over his handling over the two deadly 737 MAX crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia. And it's also surprising because just a few years ago, Boeing's board literally raised the mandatory retirement age for its CEO from 65 to 70 so Calhoun could stay in his position until April of 2028. But also at the same time, considering everything else that's been going on, his departure isn't all that shocking. Right? Even before all this, some analysts had questioned whether he had the right background to restore Boeing's reputation as an engineering-focused company rather than a profit-hungry giant that puts finances first. And those concerns have just been validated since the door plug blowout renewed concerns about Boeing's dedication to safety and transparency over financial gain, with audits finding serious lapses and the company now facing numerous federal investigations. But of course, Calhoun's just one of several big announcements, with it also being disclosed that Stan Deal, the president and CEO of Boeing's commercial airplanes unit, is set to retire immediately, and the chair of the company's board, Larry Kellner, will not be running for re-election at the upcoming annual meeting. And while some experts and analysts have praised the shakeup, others say that it does not go far enough, especially with people criticizing Calhoun's delayed departure, claiming that major changes that are seriously needed will have to wait 9 months until he actually leaves. And one expert even arguing that the whole board should resign and stand for reappointment, and saying some of those seats should go to Boeing employees who deserve more of a say. But it's also possible that more changes could be coming soon, with Calhoun saying in his message to employees that his resignation, quote, will result in a number of changes at a management and and governance level moving forward. And while he went on to detail the two departures that I already mentioned, it also seemed to leave the door open for more to come, but we're gonna have to wait to see. And then, y'all, it is March, and the biggest moments in college basketball are happening now. And that's why I've been getting deep into today's show sponsor, Prize Picks, the skill-based fantasy game where it's just you against the numbers. So all you do is pick more or less on 2 to 6 player stat projections, adjust your entry based on the potential payout displayed, and watch the winnings roll in when right. You know, I can make picks and submit my entry in less than 60 seconds. Type in the name of the player, and if you want assistance, you can find player stats from their last 5 games and averages during that span. This week, I'm picking Caitlin Clark, more than 31.5 points, Luka, more than 33.5 points, and James Harden, more than 16.5 points. And, you know, Prize Picks is the largest independently owned daily fantasy sports platform in North America with something for everyone. Basketball and hockey to League of Legends and everything in between. You can pick LeBron, Caitlin Clark, Connor McDavid, and Jude Bellingham all in the same entry. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and an enormous selection of players and stat types. I mean, it's no wonder Prize Picks is the number one fantasy sports app. So to get in on the action and to get a first deposit match of up to $100, just make sure to click the link in the description and download Prize Picks today. And then for this next story, I have a guest host, me, from over the weekend, who predicted that I was going to have technical problems, so I shot some of this show in advance.
Over $1 billion has been spent. Millions of people are still suffering, and yet there are still no real answers for people dealing with long COVID-19. Right? It's been 4 years since the pandemic began, and pretty early in, we learned that some people's symptoms were just not going away after their infections. Severe fatigue, brain fog, chronic pain, and more issues just crushing lives. With data from the beginning of the year estimating that 17.6% of U.S. adults have had long COVID and 6.8% currently have it. That means roughly 17.5 million adults are currently dealing with it. And data from last year found that around 4 million people are unable to work because of long COVID. But still, as Dr. Ziad Al-Ali, a clinical epidemiologist at Washington University in St. Louis, previously said, we developed vaccines at warp speed. We are doing trials for long COVID at snail speed. And he said this while speaking at a Senate committee hearing about the illness, where doctors and patients essentially pleaded for the government to act, noting that answers are possible if we just try and also account for how serious long COVID is.
Burden of long COVID, the burden of disease and disability from long COVID, when you measure it, is on par with the burden of cancer and heart disease.
And Dr. Al-Ali's research finding that the physical effects of the illness can last at least 2 years, but it's a mysterious illness. And no two cases always look the same or have the same timeline necessarily. And so one of the questions with this is, well, what has the government been doing? Well, as of last year, reports found that the National Institute of Health had spent over $1 billion on research that's largely turned up nothing useful for patients. There's still no FDA-approved treatment specifically for preventing or curing long COVID, and we're still working out the cause of it. And with that, you might think, really? Or maybe you feel like there's always headlines about studies on long COVID. Right? It seems like there's something new all the time. Yeah, there have been a lot of studies offering potential explanations. Some scientists pointing to lingering virus remnants causing serotonin reduction. Also earlier this year, a study identified a change in blood proteins as a potential cause. There's a decent amount of that, but some of these studies have been small, and reports still note that they only start to carve a path for potential treatments. Right? We're still in the maybe someday phase. You know, progress is progress, and that's great, but it's still just not tangible for people dealing with it right now, and their patience is wearing thin. With, for example, USA Today speaking to Sawyer Blatt, a 27-year-old patient and now advocate who said that he's tried over 50 medications, supplements, and regimens, all to no avail, explaining the urgency and finances are not meeting the moment. Right? People all over the world are feeling this as well, with the founder of Long COVID Switzerland previously telling Politico, we are just left to rot. Right? And it's really important that we emphasize the severity of the symptoms people are dealing with, right? It's so much more than, I feel a little tired or I feel a little achy. You know, during the hearing, you had people impacted by the illness talking about how it's just upended their lives. Right? One mom saying her teenage daughter, she can no longer even attend school.
Long COVID stripped away my daughter's life as she knew it. She was a straight-A honor student, an active member of the school's marching band, and had an active friend group. Now she is isolated and struggles to do her schoolwork. Instead of looking forward to a high school graduation, my 16-year-old is working slowly on her GED from home. The mild depression and anxiety she struggled with prior to COVID has only been intensified and has led to increased panic attacks and hospitalization for suicidal ideations.
Another mom saying the illness has gotten in the way of her whole family's life.
I wake up every day feeling tired, nauseous, and dizzy. I immediately start planning when I can lay down again. My kids have grown accustomed to me being sick. It makes me sad to think about my future. This may be as healthy as I get.
There's no shortage of these stories. The impacts are insanely devastating. And this is, some patients aren't even believed by doctors when they try to explain their symptoms. They're told that it's all in their head, as if anyone wants to just give up on life as they know it out of nowhere. As we've moved on from COVID and the pandemic, and we've rolled back essentially all health measures, these people feel their stories have been ignored, which then just makes it harder to get funding because they feel no one's paying attention. Well, you know, understandably, they are the main focus of the problem when you're talking about like the human element. You also have people noting that the implications and impacts of long COVID go beyond beyond just the patients. Right, in 2022, it was estimated that long COVID cost the U.S. economy at least $200 billion a year in lost productivity, wages, and medical costs. Which is why you had David Petrino, the director of rehabilitation innovation at Mount Sinai Health System, telling USA Today, "It's a problem we need to rapidly and aggressively address. Otherwise, we're all going to pay for it." You know, all of this isn't to say that nothing at all is being done, right? Of course, that is not true. For example, in February, the National Institutes of Health invested $515 million over the next 4 years into a program aimed at understanding, diagnosing, and treating long COVID, noting that right now there are 90,000 adults and children participating in observational studies all over the country. And the co-chair of that program saying, "We all want to move with a sense of urgency to what works, but it's really important that it be definitive and that we get it right. So that's why we want to do this systematically in accordance with the norms of rigorous science." I'm also noting, yeah, vaccines and treatments came relatively quickly for regular COVID, but that doesn't translate to long COVID, right? They're really their own separate beasts. And as we've gotten new updates and studies that offer potential insights, new information about related diseases, people in the field do see it all as a big deal. They celebrate the progress. They say there is hope. But again, if you are someone or you know someone and they've spent the last several years so sick they can barely get out of bed and there's still nothing that can really be done, you're not going to be thrilled that the progress hasn't turned into something more productive for you that impacts your everyday life, right? Hope is a flickering light 10 miles down the road, not a lit up street that you're walking down. And the wait for these people is made even more excruciating by the fact that the world doesn't really acknowledge COVID that much anymore. With one long hauler telling Time magazine, "How do I talk about it when people just want to forget about it? I don't get to forget. I live with it every single day. My body lives with it. My mind lives with it. But how do you bring that into conversation?" And, you know, with all this, I know this is a heavy and shitty topic, but with this, you know, I do want to end on good, or at the very least, less shitty news. And that is that right now, if you get COVID today, you're actually much less likely to get long COVID than you would have been in the past. Now, the why there is a mystery, though. Some experts think the virus is provoking a smaller immune response. Meanwhile, you have others believing the vaccination protects against long COVID to a certain degree. Though I do stress, neither of those things have been confirmed. But as we see how the situation develops, what happens with the research, I'd like to pass the question off to you. What are your thoughts, not only on this story, but what have been maybe your experiences with this, whether it be your own or just someone you know?
And then let's talk about yesterday today, where we dive into those comments and see what y'all had to say. Starting with the fact that so many of you just loved that last episode, whether it just be because of the OG Monkey intro, or y'all appreciating that outro speech, which I almost cut from the show, or just people enjoying the great topics, or me having a little more fun at times. And that brings me extra joy, because today's episode may in fact end up being one of the worst episodes I've released this year, not from like a content standpoint, but just for how hard this was to film. I've had to switch shooting locations like 4 times. The internet's crapped out on me. The equipment went wonky at times. And so honestly, like, if you're seeing this on Monday, I'm taking this as a win. Like, I just wanted to make sure that a show went out today. But also in those comments, there was a lot of conversation around people being kind of forced or pressured to speak. With Dr. MV Phil saying, "I hate when people say blank should speak out on this. Just as speech should not be censored, it should not be coerced." With people agreeing, also the outsider Jess saying, "And then they get pissed when they don't respond how they want." But then finally, regarding the UK law around cyber flashing, right, sending people unsolicited nudes, we had Crispy saying, "I love the term cyber flashing. It's so perfectly descriptive and is just exactly as weird as doing it in person and should be just as illegal." And while generally most people seem to agree with that and they were happy to see people being punished for it, you did have some like Neon J1 saying, "Someone hasn't been on Grindr, laughing crying face." So more people agreeing to the response to that saying, "Neon, you're the problem." And Jamar Brown saying, "The cyber flashing laws are needed. The fact that in so many places you can expose yourself to a stranger with absolutely no consequences is wild." But that is where your show today is gonna end. As always, thank you for watching, liking, being a part of these daily dives into the news. Also, fingers crossed, I have hope that tomorrow's show will be easier to do. But as always, my name's Philip DeFranco. You've just been filled in. I love yo faces, and I'll see you right back here tomorrow. You on my mind a lot. Don't need no time watch. I don't know how I got you in my pocket spot. Yeah, this babe, meet you every day. You light my oxygen.